You are listening to the Intentional Talk Radio Network. Welcome to Your Life, Your Health, sponsored by Central Neighborhood Health Foundation. CNHF provides quality patient-centered health care for underserved multi-ethnic communities in Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and Riverside counties. Central Neighborhood Health Foundation is a full-service Medicare-certified healthcare provider with access points in Los Angeles, San Bernardino counties. Founded in 1967, our guiding principle for nearly five decades has been the efficient and effective delivery of culturally competent care to our patient community. And without further ado, here's your host, none other than Dr. George Bell, the Outreach Director at Central Neighborhood Health Foundation, who will facilitate updates and introduce today's guest and our hot topics. So without further ado, let's bring on the one and only Dr. George Bell.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're living in rapidly changing times. The principle of acceleration is in full effect. Of course, we've had the tragedy in Florida. Southside condominium complex. The condominium collapsed on last week. And we know that there are many, many deaths involved. The last count, they updated the count to four more, and there are at least 36 people, including three children, that have been confirmed dead, and 113 others remain unaccounted for since this 12-story residential building partially collapsed. We're living in changing times. It just seems like there are incidents, there's tragedies, circumstances that are surrounding us. But even in a world like this, as Jesse Jackson says, keep hope alive. We're yet hearing updates daily. They're holding press conferences daily there in Florida. And so we want to be prayerful for these families. The circumstances, they look rather dim, but I serve a God that is a miracle worker. And I'm going to pose this to you. I'm going to declare this to you, that you would be prayerful in times like this. The nation is waiting with hope in view. The officials there in Florida, they're doing the best they can. There were days of inclement weather, but yet they're working diligently. They're putting in the time. So I'm believing that there will be some positive outcome for them. Well, it's good to be with everybody this Tuesday. And we have a wonderful guest with us. I'm going to introduce him in just a few moments, but I was just wondering, Yolanda, do you have any thoughts behind the Florida Miami-Dade County incident?
Actually, no, I don't, except that it's very, very sad. It's very sad. It is amazing that people are coming out of this tragedy alive. And as you have said, keep hope alive. It's simply a horrible, horrible thing. The building owner, he doesn't have enough. He just will not have enough to cover this. It is a tragedy like none other. And we've seen other tragedies before, but this is just, and I hate to think that it's a tragedy due to negligence. It's a tragedy due to greed. We don't know, but nonetheless, lives have been lost. Lives have been lost. So there isn't a whole lot that can be said. But do you have any word on the Delta variant? You're there at Central Neighborhood Health Foundation. What are they talking about?
Well, no, I'm not going to get into that on today. I'm going to spend much of our time with our guest. It's a dear friend of mine for, believe it or not, some 47 years, 57 years.
57.
But I yes.
And I thought you were only 40.
Here we go. 96.3 to Beat Talk. Okay.
Well, that's what you said.
Yeah, but I'm going to go back to the collapse, because that sparked a conversation here in Los Angeles. You know, they began to look at that condominium in Marina del Rey.
Oh, yeah.
So I would imagine that this is going to trigger.
Yes,
the building and safety. Janice Hahn, she led a team of individuals over there on last week, and they inspected the building. Of course, they said there wasn't anything that necessitated immediate correction.
Action. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think this is going to really, I mean, that is such a tragedy in Florida. Florida, because in safety, they had been there, in and out of there, you know, time after time, and they cited these deficiencies in the building. And so now we have Janice Hahn here in Los Angeles, and she's spearheading this inspection in the Marina del Rey area. So I think we should be ahead of the curve rather than behind the curve.
Yes, absolutely.
Life. Yeah. So, you know, kudos to Janet Hahn for jumping on that. You know, I normally don't jump into politics or things like that, but I'm glad she's doing.
I am too. Yeah.
And I would also propose that she do something in the inner city, not just in Marina del Rey. There are people. Mm-hmm. I'm into outreach. That's what I do. I go in and out of a lot of environments. Some are just dilapidated. And of course, the homeless. Let's do something about those issues that are still yet not attended to effectively, that continue to plague the city of Los Angeles.
So, yeah, because there are so many. There are so many.
Say what?
There's so many.
So many, yeah, yeah. But I'm really, really surprised you don't have much to say on this one.
I don't. What could I possibly have to say except that I feel so badly for those people?
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing else to say. It's a horrible, horrible tragedy, like so many others, but this is the collapse of a building that people lived in, really. And remember that, from what I understand, and I have not been that way in a while, but on La Cienega and Jefferson, maybe, or La Cienega and Coliseum, somewhere, they're building 30-story residential buildings. And it would be commerce on the bottom and residential on the top.
Yes.
And that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. Really? Come on.
Well, there might be a strong foundation because it's near a hill. There might be some geology, you know, that helps to support the building. I have the renditions of that new, the new Baldwin Hills, correct? That's what you're talking about?
Is that what that is?
You're talking about?
On La Cienega and just north of, I think it would be north of where Target is.
Oh, no, I'm talking about Baldwin Hills Mall. That's going to become a
structure. Okay, that's over on Crenshaw.
Well, there have been
that's on Crenshaw.
Renditions completed on, Well, again, you know, I just, again, my heart goes out for those families. I just can't imagine, you know, such a tragedy happening to a family member and what they're thinking and what they're feeling, what they're going through, the suspense that their loved one is beneath the rock. And so, again, our prayers go out for them. Yeah, they're in our hearts. So on today, we have Dr. Enrico Melson with us, and he has a list of credentials and degrees and honors that can go on and on and on. And I've known him again. I'm backpedaling. We've known each other for over 50 years. We grew up together in the city of Compton. And so I posed the question, can any good thing come out of Compton? Yes, it did. Well, of course, it's Enrico, not me. But anyway, so, yeah, we grew up. Yeah. And, you know, but before he earned his MD, you know, he came from humble beginnings. And perhaps we'll chat about that in a few minutes. I can remember the summer of 1968. We were in a music program, and our instructor was Mr. Mistretta over at Carver Elementary School in the city of Los Angeles. And there he is on his clarinet and sometime the oboe. And I'm back there banging on the drums as usual. You know, then from there to Willowbrook Junior High, and he was playing clarinet and now and then oboe. I was about to say something else. I shouldn't say what I was thinking.
Don't say that.
Yeah, it almost slipped out. It almost slipped out. But after, I mean, you know, he was there at Willowbrook, and then poof, he was gone. He didn't even bid us farewell, you know.
And he didn't mean farewell. He was just off to bigger and better things.
Yes, he was. He was off to bigger and better things. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So just to get into it.
Oh, he froze. Okay. Well, he will be back. So, Dr. Melson, tell us about you while we're waiting for George to unfreeze.
Well, actually, if it's all right with you, I'd just like to chime in with a couple of comments. That's still a comment on the situation in Florida.
Okay, I don't mean to interrupt, but Dr. Melson, we're having some issues with your sound.
My sound?
Yeah,
yes.
It's very low and muffled.
Is that any better?
Yeah, that is better, yes. If you could get a little bit louder, that would be great. The muffleness is gone, but it needs to be just a tad louder.
How's that now?
Yeah, that's much better.
That's better. Yep.
Okay, good, good. If it's all right with you guys, before I go into launching about myself, if I can just add a comment or two quickly about the Florida situation.
Sure.
I think people need to understand that this collapse of this condo is the first in what is most likely to be a substantial chain of building collapses that will take place. Remember, people have to understand that Florida, half of the state of Florida at least, is reclaimed swampland.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
So what we understand by the predictions on the global warming trajectories for the 21st century, that somewhere by the time 2050 to 2070 or so comes about, if global warming continues at the rate that it's going, two-thirds of the state of Florida will be underwater. And so it is not sufficient. It is not sufficient to simply project that the coasts will gradually come in like so. That gives everybody time to get out and adjust their property values, buy other lands and stuff of this sort. No, what we're seeing is an indication that the configuration, the natural geologic and marinara configuration is restoring itself. And so you can look at the strip of Miami Beach. You can look at hundreds of buildings like that in Surfside as quite likely to be crumbling throughout the planet. We've estimated that 60% of the planet's population lives within 30 miles of any ocean, and that this is expected to then necessitate a migration of somewhere on the order of at least 3 billion people who have to move inland from their current locales over the course of the rest of this century, and maybe only the next half century or less because of the global warming situation. So when we add to that the destabilization of tectonic plate activity, we add to that further things that will be revealed insofar as the what we understand as the lack of integrous operations of construction all around the planet. Florida is a state that is known to have a plethora of scandalous construction activity historically. And so we will see a lot of this, unfortunately, as things unfold further. So I just wanted to add that little piece.
Well, thank you very much for that. And if Florida has that going on, think about California, because I'm now hearing California will eventually boil itself up and fall off into the drink. So with all of the fires, the drought, all of those things that take place, and remember, California has not seen 10 days of rain, all of 21. And I don't remember much rain in 2020. So the burning of California is what's going to happen sooner rather than later. And my prediction is somewhere around, I don't know, the next 20 years, 30 years, it'll just be burning, because it happens every year that it burns, burns, burns. And some of these areas where the ground gives way and the main line breaks, it bursts, and there's a flood everywhere. Remember the one at UCLA. Remember the one downtown LA. So it happens frequently. And for those people who don't believe in global warming or climate change, they're causing a lot of problems for a lot of people, because global warming is real. It is real. It's not made up. Thank you, Doctor.
Welcome.
We've got George back.
Welcome
back.
Yeah,
I had a technical problem right in the middle of saying something there, giving my dear brother his accolades, well earned. But you just want to talk briefly about where you come from, and how does an adolescent from ninth grade go poof and lead on to what we call Dr. Melson today?
You know, George and I were always vertically challenged, so. Coming up, we were amongst the shortest of the guys, actually the shortest of all students in our respective classes for quite some time. And, you know, not being necessarily gifted in sports or things of that sort, I was a good athlete. I was definitely a good athlete. I was actually seventh grade wrestling champion, in case you didn't know that, with Mr. Linhart.
Ninth grade MVP on the Willowbrook baseball team.
Okay. So, but the thing was, long before there was hip hop and rap music, there was education. The way to liberation, the way to success was always going to be education in our family, in our culture for the most part. And so that was something that my parents pushed more than anything else. We were fortunate. George may not, you may or may not know this, George, but at the time that we were going to school in Compton Unified School District, our school district ranked in the bottom 1% in the nation.
Yes.
It ranked in the bottom 1% in the nation. I was fortunate in my family to test in the 99.8 plus percentile for the nation, coming out of the bottom 1% of the nation. And correspondingly, my brothers and sisters did as well in these national standardized tests. And as a result, we were given opportunities to go and matriculate into the rich white boys and rich white girls prep schools. And then it created all kinds of other challenges. Those challenges of being on welfare, you know, five in a one bedroom apartment, that kind of thing, and then going to school side by side with kids who themselves in 1969 had personal fortunes in the multi-millions of dollars, 14, 18 million. I remember a couple of my classmates, that was their own spending money, let alone what they had in their families. And to be side by side with these kids, nonetheless, we excelled, all of us. And there was a year I took off, 10th grade, came back to Compton, and to join the revolution. I went straight on over to Stockwell to join the Black Panther Party in the local Southern California headquarters office. I spent that sophomore year trying to understand things that were happening in terms of political and social unrest and injustice issues. And eventually, due to certain contradictions in the movements, as well as the success of the counterintelligence program delivered upon the masses of the people by the FBI, CIA, etc., I had reached a crisis. And guess what? The school let me come back. I was able to go back and finish up 11th and 12th grade. And from there, it was just an easy step to graduate, you know, with honors and go on to Harvard University. So I spent 4 years at Harvard, and as an undergraduate, I was pre-med and public health major. I was only the second student in 350 years of Harvard's history at that point to create an undergraduate degree program in public health. As a result, I decided to go on and finish my master's in public health, because when I graduated with my bachelor's, I had half of my master's already. So I went to UC Berkeley and had a year up there to finish up my master's. And then I went on down and did medical school between University of California at Irvine and also at Stanford University. I then went on back to New York and spent another 5 years in advanced postdoctoral residency training. And then I went into the public health service, did 4.5 years with them, did a lot of other trainings and qualifications in many other areas of medicine, Western medicine, of course, especially what we call allopathic medicine. I then also, however, because of the way our family has oriented, I was always interested in the power of the mind. And so I used to watch my father hypnotize my oldest brother when I was a little kid. And I was fascinated with that. So as early as 1979, I was studying medical hypnosis, hypnotherapy, in the Department of Psychiatry for pain control and addiction control and things of this sort. And then I went on to study neurolinguistic programming and many other different systems of mind-body integration. I also then began to study and practice Ayurvedic medicine from India. Shamanic medicine, healing processes, bioenergetic medicine, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I grabbed up a lot of credentials along the way. I was fascinated and sort of, you know, I got caught up in becoming a credentialaholic. But I was fortunate in the sense that I was always able to be in a position of service, continuing service in the community while I was garnering credentials all around the world. And it eventually brought me back to Central Neighborhood Health Foundation. And that was a big surprise when...
That was long after many, well, I won't say many other stops, but there were stops along the way, correct?
Yeah, there were a lot of stops along the way.
Then we'll talk about our serendipitous reuniting at CNHF, right? Okay.
Okay. Other things that began to happen when I was a little boy was I had a lot of spiritual, metaphysical, and paranormal experiences going all the way back to my infancy. I can remember things that happened when I was less than a year old, things that happened when I was 5 years of age, when I was 7 years of age, 9 years of age, and things of this sort. And I'm talking about, you know, hardcore, really serious divine encounters. And this also shaped within me a larger ethos and an understanding of my purpose in existence. I was really, really humbled, even at such an early age, to understand that I was sent here on a mission and that I did not have an opportunity to just toss that to the side. I didn't have that kind of entitlement. So I've always live my life with a strong sense of purpose and a strong sense of mission and a strong sense of duty. So that's also the other part that's been there. And along the way, I've been able to travel to over 100 countries. I've been able to work in a professional capacity in over 70 countries of various sorts, whether it's been doing some aspect of healing work, whether it's Western medicine, Eastern medicine, spiritual healing. I also have a doctorate in applied spiritual healing, and I also have a doctorate, an honorary doctorate in natural medicine. So whether I've been able to work in a lot of those capacities, or I've worked in capacities with technology development, I've had parallel careers in international telecommunications network development, supercomputer grid design, computer information technology systems, advanced learning systems, things of this sort. Spiritually, I've been able to grow. I've been able to attain states that they, in many traditions, would call enlightenment. I've been able to attain recognitions by many traditions around the world, by the peoples of those places. Oftentimes, I've been summoned to country only to find out that I've been identified in some prophecies, and that cuts across so many different forms of religiosity and spirituality in systems all around the world. I, again, have come to understand that that is not something to flatter myself with. It's just each time that something like that has happened, it has thrust upon me yet a whole nother set of responsibilities that I have to address. And in addressing those responsibilities, I can only do so through selfless service. Addressing it through selfless service, I must also recognize that I've had to essentially acknowledge and release any sense of entitlement. I don't have the entitlement to rest. I don't have the entitlement to take time off. I don't have the entitlement to be angry at people. I don't have the entitlement to be petty, to be controlling, things of this sort. So it's everything about my way of being and conducting myself is actually subsumed under a larger construct of my spirituality. And so I just wake up every morning and start to work again. During the night, I work spiritually. I work out of body during the night. I do remote energetic healing. I do spiritual healing and things of that sort. So I hope that fills in enough, George.
Well, yeah, it does. But I want to go back to 2005. I think we had gathered with our group, you know, how we gather our class of 73 and we get together here and there. But around that time, you came over to the Union Rescue Mission. So I can attest to what you're saying, the emptying out. The kenosis, the emptying out of the self, and in service to mankind. And now, you know, you came there, you brought your son with you. It was a weekend. And I can remember you coming in on a Saturday, and you came back on a Sunday, and me with my self-gratifying self, I'm like, dude, I'll see you later. I left you there at the mission, and I was... And I went out, I said, this is the weekend, I'm going to go and rest. You know, I've been attending to the mission and the men and the women and the children and the mission. And I really, I'm going to tell you something. I was really, really taken by that. That really, you know, the emptying out, you know, all of that. I'm like, wow, I don't have that. I want to go ride motorcycles on Saturday morning. Amen. And, I want to go get a tan because, you know, you and me, you know, Enrico, we're a little bit on the, I don't know, somebody, that gene pool was messed up somewhere along the way. So in order for me to become black, I have to get a tan. Okay. So.
Caramel.
Yeah. But, you know, I was just fascinated by that and how you were, again, your son was accompanying you and you were teaching selflessness. And I'm like, wow, that is so awesome. So I've just always admired that, you know, Enrico. I really do. And I hope you know that.
Thank you, brother.
That, you know, I think we're journeying. We're taking our journey. We're learning along the way. But again, just going back to your professional, position in life or your professional stature in life. Now, you mentioned pain management and disability evaluation. So, and then we're going to talk about the epidemiology piece too, because, you know, Yolanda wanted to hear something about COVID, and I'm sure you'll be able to fill in a few blanks on that. But when it comes to pain management, and, you know, there are so many people experiencing chronic diseases, and we've worked together. Now for everybody that's listening, Enrico, Dr. Melson, in 2019, I was sitting on the board of Central Neighborhood Health Foundation, and the chief operating officer, as I came into the board room, we're going to meet, and we began to talk. She says, I'm interviewing a new doctor. And she said, I'm in
2018.
Okay. She said, I'm interviewing Dr. Melson. And in my mind, there's only one Dr. Melson. I said, is that Enrico Melson? And she said, yes. I said, well, you know, here, you know, we're from the hood. So, yeah, I grew up with Enrico, you know. And so yes. And I was like, this is a small world. So, you know, and which brings me to the larger bit I was going to talk about, because we have that Health Homes program for people that are dealing with chronic diseases, not just pain management. So it was around that time that things begin to evolve. So I just often wondered how you arrived at Central Neighborhood Health Foundation. Was there like some type of, did you pull a rabbit out of the hat? What happened?
Well, actually, it was one of those things that I have to go back to several months before that, about 6-8 months before that. In late 2017, I had reached a decision that my life in this body was coming to an end. I've gone through many transitions, of which you can call death transitions and what you can call ascension transitions, because of my spiritual progressions over the decades. And so in light of the services that each one of those sort of initiation phases and expansion phases then begins to bring forth, there was a sense of duty that basically the next step of my responsible service was to be full-time in the spirit realm. And so I was going back to India and to do what was called the Mahasamadhi. The Mahasamadhi is the time when the yogi or the guru or the Rinpoche or the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, goes into intense meditation and stays in that state for however long it is necessary, and may generally often be a period of maybe 7 to 10 days or so, and then it's determined that they are out of their body and then the cosmos and all. And if it is determined at that time that they transition, and then the life force, the remaining life force in the body, is released. And so they just remain in these cosmic states of cosmic consciousness, and working as spirit master beings. So I had already been given those kinds of instructions. So I went back to India. It's my fourth trip to India, and was intending for that. However, my daughter went with me because she was very interested in staying at an ashram. And I wanted to make sure, of course, that if she was going to commit herself to a spiritual life, and particularly living on the other side of the planet, that it was going to check out to be the right place. And it had left some things to be desired. It wasn't really quite the right place for her, and it wasn't something that I could fully endorse. And so as a result, after several months, it was necessary for me to come back, make sure my daughter came back to the States and got herself situated and back on track with her education. And I was intending fully to just literally just be in LA for a few months. 2 to 4 months, and then get my behind back to India and get on with what I was supposed to be doing. And I got this phone call from a recruiter, and saying, you know, hey, could you give 2 months to this community clinic chain? And I said, well, you know, I could make a little bit extra money and stabilize my daughter a little bit more. My sons are fine. Yeah, I can do that. And then I can, you know, take a few nickels and fly on back to India and be done with things. And that's when I met Eleanor. I met the chief operations officer, and I met the chief medical officer at that time, Dr. Diop. And we got to talking. And then, you know, Eleanor hit me with this line. She said, listen, if you're going to go and give yourself to the starving, homeless, poor people in the streets of Calcutta, India, and places like that, and then pass on, why can't you do that for the hungry, homeless people right here in downtown LA?
Right.
So she hit me. That was like way.
She'll hit you. She'll
that
hit
was
you.
Like in the gut deep, you know? And so I had to say, well, she said, I know you were saying you're only going to be here for a few months, but I need 2 years. I need you to give a commitment of 2 years. And so this is where one of the issues comes down to is that even when one feels spiritually compelled for something, it is also important not to become fixated in attachment even to that compulsion itself. And I had to recognize that service is service wherever I am. And there was another level of calling. So that rather than go back to India, I said, all right, I'll sign on the dotted line. And that began my journey with CNHF. It's now been over 3 years. I still am working on a part-time basis. I have worked in a number of different capacities, you know, within the organization and kind of all over the place. And, you know, kind of like George was talking about, I'm here and then all of a sudden it's poof. And it looks like Rico's gone again. But then somebody says, no, he's still helping the organization in some other kind of way.
Yes. Yeah.
Consulting here or he's out in the hinterlands out there doing something.
So I was at Coachella today.
So anyway, I'm not reassigned to return to India anytime soon. I do my work.
I did miss you.
Thank you, brother. I do my human work in the daytime, and then I do my cosmic work in the evenings. I live in a chair. I've been living out of a chair for the past 8 years, a little bit over 8 years. So I rarely get into a bed and actually lie down at night. I get in a chair and I go into meditation. I go out of my body and I do that kind of work. I do energetic healing work. I do depossession work. I do work with the cosmic masters. I do work with the galactic councils. This kind of work that many people would think is not possible. But that has to do with the assignments that I was shown, that I was sent here for. So it is all the time service. I don't, again, like I say, I don't even have a time to take off the night times. And so I just have managed to live this life. I trained myself when I was 15 to live on 4 hours or less per night of sleep. And I've lived that way since 1971. So that's the winding road that got me to CNHF, and so far can't cut the cord.
Well, you know, you come with credentials, and it's, you know, I was just thinking about it today in lieu of this interview on today, and you know, there are people that have the essential wherewithal to cover, and those credentials at a very needed time. They were so much on time. And the truth be told, Central Neighborhood Health Foundation needed you. Okay? That's the truth about it. And because you were flexible and willing to, and selfless enough to, again, navigate the minutiae, that's a reason why Central Neighborhood Health Foundation is flourishing the way it does. You went to H Street. You went to Coachella and you'll be doing many other things because of your heart. And I know that. So, you know, we're grateful for you, Enrico. We really are. Dr. Aduna, Eleanor, myself, and of course, the other senior leadership team, you know, we're grateful for you and how you do come with a heart of service. It's just a blessing to us. So now I have a whole list of things, you know, in preparing, you know, I was asking you for questions. And so I have those questions, but I just began to Google Dr. Enrico Melson. And now tell me, how come I don't know about the siege in Beirut and the massacre at Sabra, Shatila? How come I don't know these things? And we're hanging out together and you're not telling me about Lebanon and, you know, and all this stuff. And so you have all these international connections. And I'm going to say this. I was part of one of your, convocations when we did the Hospitaller of St. Lazarus, right? And he's knighted. Enrico Melson is a knight. And so he brought me in supposedly for my humanitarian work, and I was knighted as well. That was a highlight. I really enjoyed it. And so you do all these things, and there are some things that we can talk about on the air, but some things obviously we can't. But the things that we can, you know, when I look at your work and volunteerism in these volatile countries, man, I mean, you are, you know, really fearless in so many ways, and your mission and your purpose supersede the self. And that just amazed me. But the thing is, and in Nicaragua, right? So in Colombia, all these countries, you've done this work. You think I didn't know. Since you won't tell me, I'm going to find out myself, right? So, you know, there's so many things you do. And so now we talked about what led you to CNHF and how that happened. And we were talking earlier, and, you know, there are a lot of, there are a lot of physicians that are textbook Western practices. And then there are the others, the homeopaths, right? Homeopaths. And so without becoming too esoteric, because I'm going to have to keep a leash on you. I know who you are. I know you might just fly away right now. I know what's up. Okay. So, are there any conflicts in your approach to medicine, as opposed to your unconventional approach, even though you have the conventional approach and you do that which is appropriate, but are there any conflicts with this unconventional approach of medicine versus conventional?
Well, I have had to straddle. I've had to transcend. Very rarely I've had to bulldoze, but for the most part, I've had to artfully navigate, negotiate a terrain that has within it a wide diversity of different interests. To become a doctor, you have to be trained in how to think. Just like if you were a sniper in the military, you have to be trained in how to think. If you're a fighter pilot, if you're an astronaut, it's not just a bunch of things of what to know. It's about how to think. Unfortunately, nowadays, the system of medicine is so much involved in untraining, so that how to think does not capitalize on, nor does it optimize the use of human intelligence. And so we have more and more this devolution into this sort of cookie cutter recipe kind of format. A lot of it, we call it so-called best practices. A lot of it, we call it so-called evidence-based medicine. And so in that sense, there is a lot of dogma in medicine. There are those who practice Western medicine as a form of religion. I look at the term discipline. The root word of discipline is disciple. So we have these disciplines of medicine which can become rigid. And so whenever there is rigidity in any kind of institutionalized system, that rigidity is going to be counterproductive. And so what we see here when someone attempts, not just myself, but when someone takes time and devotes herself or himself to the mastery and the expertise garnering and the credentialing within multiple fields, cross disciplines, which they themselves are not necessarily all confluent, then we'll find oneself often in a position where there is the apparent oppositional nature of knowledge from one system against knowledge from another system. What I have been able to do, and again, this is also because of, in the famous words of Dr. Kenneth Orduña, this is divine providence. I have been gifted with the opportunity of a perspectivization in order to be able to see what reconciles that which appears to be oppositional and turn it into what I call appositional. So instead of things butting heads, one thing against another, let it be side by side. And let it be that an Eastern approach or mind-body spiritual approach can coexist with a Western scientific, allopathic, reductionistic, materialistic approach. And vice versa. That is recognizing that in the true words of the Hippocratic Oath, in the true sense of the dictates and of the desiderata, in what we really understand, the historical roles of a physician as not only a healer, but also as a priest, a priested person, so that these are higher responsibilities. And so in order to be able to transcend and to manage coming from so many different systems that I've been trained in and exposed to and practiced in, I have to maintain what I call an integral awareness approach, an integral awareness medica, which, by the way, is an acronym for I am. So I have been able to develop, I've been gifted with the opportunity to develop what I call the integral awareness metasystems. These are systems of giving us a perspective of how to combine the different disciplines and things of this sort. I've been able, as a result, then to be in conferences and to explain myself, because sometimes my colleagues have not taken too kindly to me being so far out of the box. But then I just let them know. I said, but at the same time, do you see what's in the box? Is it still there? And they go, yes, it is. I said, that's right. So I tell you that I tell the patient, listen, you know, what I'm offering you is supplemental in addition to that which is the foundational. You're visiting here a Western medicine clinic. You are entering into an environment where there's an expectation of certain standards of knowledge and practice. And that is provided. At the same time, there is much, much more to who you are, how you think, how you experience life, how your feelings, your thoughts, your belief systems affect your health, affect your immune system functioning, affect your stress management levels, etc. I must give you that which is also supplemental to the basic foundational approach, which is that upon which you agreed to when you entered this clinic environment. So I've taken that approach. Now, the times when it is just substitutional is when the patient can tell me, I'm not interested. I don't want the drugs. I don't want this form or that form of your white coat medicine, doctor. I want something else.
Yeah.
So I say, okay, in that sense, you've come to the right person because I can give you also that which is substitutional. Yet most of the time, what they accept is that which is a greater package of information that is more empowering to them, because it is supplemental and foundational. And there need not be, as I said, there need not be this oppositional nature of one system of healing and practice towards another. Instead, the appositional, the side by side.
Yes.
Hope that's useful.
Our late founder, Dr. Bassett Brown, he said something a couple of few years ago, and we were just chatting, and he said that we're medical evangelists. And that's always stuck with me. He attended Loma Linda University, which is a Seventh-day Adventist institution, and he brought that with him. They were into preparing medical evangelists to go out. I know that's a different level than what you're talking about, but yet it still encompasses the spiritual aspect. And how can we heal without addressing the spiritual? And, you know, just to look at the scope of faith-based institutions, some are within the stand within orthodoxy and some don't. But nevertheless, from culture to culture, that's just the way it is. And if it's benefiting a person and bringing wholeness and wellness, I'm not mad at you, you know, because we all come from different parts of the world. Now, I think, you know, the inflexibility there of, you know, one divine authority against another, that's that pitting people that way against one another. I do believe that there's one way personally, but however, I do meet in settings where there is interfaith collaboration. So we bring that, and there are people that are getting results from that. So, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I'm just not quite ready to go to the 10th dimension right now. You know, I'll stop at 5, Enrico. You know what I'm saying? I'm cool with 5. I'm not ready to do 10, man. But you know, I get it. I get it. And I meditate. My form of meditation may be a little different from yours. I use meditation of the scriptures, you know. I do imaging. I envision. I do all of that. It's just different. And I think we should learn to appreciate one another's differences. Just because we're not cookie cutter, it doesn't make us so, it doesn't ostracize us. So with that said, you know, I just have this burning question. We only have a short amount of time. There are a lot of people that are asking, or no, let me rephrase that. They're not asking. There are a lot of people that are saying that CBD has been such, your eyes roll back in the back of your head there, Enrico. CBD has helped them tremendously. But then on the other hand, there are others that say it didn't have any impact at all. What is with that?
Okay. Well, it's interesting because you're asking that question on a day when this week, actually, just yesterday, the California State Legislature just passed a bill that is decriminalizing multiple psychotropic plant medicines. This is a great historic time. We're looking at a situation where basically the shadowy side of science is being exposed. CBD is actually a group of compounds. So we need to look at it more than just a singularity. But in essence, what we're looking at is God has created all the medicines.
Yes, he has.
All the foods that do not require this synthetic distillation, hyperfractionalization, and isolation of one so-called active ingredient that may be part of hundreds or thousands of chemicals that are in perfect balance in their natural state in that which we may call a plant. We know that so many of the medicines that are used in the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceuticals, are originally plant-derived.
Yes.
Or at least the root of them are plant-derived. And then we have, because of this mania that we've had so much for greed and for ownership, we change a few little atoms here on the overall molecules, and then we run off to the patent office and file a patent so that then we can make billions of dollars. But in essence, what we're dealing with is that particular family of plant medicines are, first of all, they are sacraments and not just medicines, particularly when they are handled in sacred ceremonial environments and in accordance with proper ceremonial ritualistic disciplines, such as the same for wine, such as the same for so many that have been used in sacred ceremonies for hundreds of thousands of years. And I'm saying hundreds of thousands of years, not thousands of years, because the human species has been through many stages, and there have been many stages where in which there has been civilizations on this planet before that have risen and fallen. But what we understand is that CBD, as that category of plants, the hemp family of plants, literally have thousands of uses, hundreds at least already identified. There are thousands that can be identified. We know that there are direct linkages to potentiating the effects of the immune system complex. Part of the issue that has to take place, however, is that we have conditioned ourselves to be so much against possibilities, and we have rigidified the internal structure and operations of the central nervous system through the toxins in our environment, particularly heavy metal toxins. Calcifications of the pineal gland have been brought about by fluoridation of water, by the high infusions of lead in the environment from all the decades that we had of lead in gasoline. The even vaccines carry high doses, high quantities of heavy metals, particularly aluminum and lead and mercury. Things of this sort have been associated with vaccines for decades. We know that we have put billions of teeth, of fillings into teeth, using heavy toxic metals, which go straight into the nervous system, particularly to the brain. We know that these things isolate and interfere with a lot of the optimal functioning of the nervous system. So that CBD is one of those categories, or the hemp family of plant medicines. They operate in a number of ways to help restore an optimization of neurotransmitter function in the brain and in the rest of the nervous system. And as a result, the natural intelligence that's already pre-programmed by the divine, the God-given intelligence of our homeostatic and pro-evolutional metabolism, can then operate in a better way. It is important to recognize that when we talk about the effects of things, there is a Vedic saying that everything in the universe can be a food. Everything in the universe can be a poison. Everything in the universe can be a medicine. It depends on consciousness. So if we label something with a broad stroke as being something bad and terrible, then we limit the opportunity to experience those things, whatever they are, in other ways, particularly ways that could be beneficial to us when we are labeling them with such a prejudice and such a broad stroke as being bad. So what is happening in this revolution now of unfolding and decriminalization and illegitimization of so many things is that we see that with disciplined, proper scientific and proper spiritual and proper communal practice, then these curative properties, these consciousness expansion properties, these community facilitational properties can also be recognized by not only these particular plants, but by so many, so many more. That then becomes our next level of responsibility as practitioners, as healers, as physicians, as scientists, as policymakers, as leaders, and also as parents in terms of how we teach our children as to what is the proper way to navigate the world. Hope that's useful.
You have been listening to Your Life, Your Health, sponsored by Central Neighborhood Health Foundation, with main offices located at 714 West Olympic Boulevard in Los Angeles, Suite 801-90015. And for additional information, visit our website at cnhfclinics.org, info@cnhfclinics.org, and visit our social media sites at Central Neighborhood Health Foundation at facebook.com and also Central Neighborhood Health Foundation's _clinics at Instagram. Don't forget the COVID-19 testing and also COVID-19 vaccines. You have been listening to the Intentional Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Central Neighborhood Health Foundation. It's your life, your health with Dr. Julie.